The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purpose of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Program material may not be edited for use in promotional material by any political party or other organization, and may not be used in any edited form that could mislead or misinform an audience or viewer, or which does not present a balanced portrayal of the proceedings in the House. Video program material may only be used with its original audio components, and no other audio material may be added to video material used. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.
Good morning. I'd like to call a meeting to order. I'd like to start by having everyone introduce themselves, and I'll start with the NDP.
Jim Boudreau, MLA for Guy's Rasheed Harbour.
Good morning. Matt Wynott, MLA, Hammonds Plains, Upper Sackville.
Morning. Brian Skibar, the member for Cumberland North.
Morning. Gary Ramey, a member for Lunenburg West.
Graham Steele, the MLA for Halifax Fairview, substituting today for the member for Halifax Chabucto.
Andrew Younger, Dartmouth East.
Good morning, Alan McMaster, Inverness.
Morning, Eddie Oral, MLA Cape Breton North, substituting for Mr. Chuck Porter.
Terry Spicer, Assistant Auditor General.
Darlene Henry, Committee Clerk.
Weldon Myers, Finance Resources Corporate Service Unit.
Sarah Jane Snook, Deputy Minister at Environment.
Peter Labor, Director of Protected Areas and Wetlands with Nova Scotia Environment.
Duff Montgomery, Deputy Minister of Natural Resources.
Gretchen Polkamp, Executive Director of Land Services for Natural Resources.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Keith Caldwell, Chair of the Committee. And I'd like to start by asking whichever one of the departments would like to go with the presentations first. I'll leave it to you, maybe Environment first.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for inviting us here today to talk about Nova Scotia's commitment to land protection and our progress in achieving the province's 12% goal. Joining me this morning is Mr. Peter Labor, Director of our Protected Areas and Wetlands Branch with the Department of Environment. And you've already heard Deputy Montgomery and Gretchen Polkamp and Wendell Myers introduce themselves. Like all Nova Scotians, we value our environmentally significant lands, and we want to ensure that they are protected now and for the future generations. This desire, along with a legislated target, drives much of the work we do within our departments. Nova Scotians and visitors have long enjoyed the province's extensive coastline, scenic views, and numerous beaches, as well as our diverse forests, lakes, and rivers. Our province's natural beauty is a big part of what makes Nova Scotia a great place for families to live and work. We want to ensure that as much land as possible is available for Nova Scotians to use and enjoy now and into the future. To achieve this, the province committed to protect 12% of Nova Scotia's land by 2015. This commitment became law in 2007 when government passed the Environmental Goals and Sustainable Prosperity Act. I am happy to report that we are making excellent progress towards achieving Nova Scotia's land protection goal. As of today, about 9.4% of the province has been legally protected. A tremendous amount of work has gone into designating our most precious lands and identifying the further lands required. A review of Crown and large forest lands was conducted to identify the best options for protection. Interdepartmental committees were established to coordinate planning and decision-making. A multi-phase planning and consultation process was established, and extensive public and stakeholder consultations were held. Our work to protect Nova Scotia's lands is supported in part through funding agreements with the Nature Conservancy of Canada and the Nova Scotia Nature Trust. These funding agreements enable the organizations to purchase lands that help us meet our goal. Our process for protection takes into account economic impacts on resources and other industries and potential effects on land use interests. That is why we have consulted and continue to engage with representatives in forestry, mining, petroleum, and other industries, as well as off-highway vehicle groups, hunting and angling associations, municipalities, and others. Working with Nova Scotians, we are able to identify and protect sensitive lands while supporting a prosperous and sustainable economy. Over the past 3 years, the province alone has protected more than 54,000 hectares of land. Our work continues as we move forward in identifying the remaining 2.6% of lands required to reach our goal. Nova Scotia's protected areas are being protected by and for Nova Scotians. We are pleased to be here today to discuss our progress and our plans for moving forward in achieving the province's 12% goal. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Montgomery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nova Scotians feel very strongly about their land and, more importantly, how it gets used. As members know, the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Environment share the mandate of protecting those lands. Fundamental to the province's natural resources strategy is the conservation and sustainable use of biodiversity, including forests and parks. Provincial parklands, which represent approximately 0.5% of Nova Scotia's land base, are part of the 12% protected areas and play a very important role in the diverse mix of life in our province's biodiversity. Our two departments work closely in selecting, purchasing, and designating lands. Existing Crown land, which is under the authority of Natural Resources, has made up the largest portion of those protected lands. Our department is also responsible for managing provincial parks, which are part of the protected areas system. Nova Scotians continually tell us they want land protected and preserved for future generations, for their recreational and traditional uses, for parks, protection, forestry, for wildlife management, and for Aboriginal uses. We want to ensure that Nova Scotians have access to more land in order that they can use, enjoy, and protect it now and for future generations. This is particularly important here in our province, where we have the second lowest percentage of Crown land in all of Canada. Only 32% of Nova Scotia, 4.2 million acres, is owned by the province. This is the second lowest level of government land ownership in Canada, just ahead of PEI. We also have the second smallest land base. The size of Nova Scotia land base cannot be changed. However, we can change the amount of land that is owned by the province. Having more of our land under provincial control is an important goal. Increasing the provincial land base allows us to manage the land for the benefit of all Nova Scotians. Beyond protecting the ecological value of our lands, we also need to ensure the sustainable use of this resource for individuals who depend upon it to grow their companies and provide good jobs for Nova Scotians here and into the future. Government's land purchases continue to be praised by many people and many diverse groups in Nova Scotia. And we've worked with many Nova Scotians to select the best land, including stakeholders in the forestry industry, environmental groups, the Mi'kmaq, and local communities. We've negotiated good deals, and we'll work to ensure that any future land purchases are made for the right reasons. Our land purchases have brought us much closer to our goal of protecting the 12% of the provincial land mass by 2015. And we look forward to our continuing our work with the Department of Environment in reaching this goal. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Well, first round of questions will be Mr. Younger for 20 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentations. I think I might direct my
at least first couple questions generally, because I'm not sure whether Environment and Natural Resources is best to answer them. You have been going through a process to identify potential protected lands to reach the 12%. I'm wondering, I recognize that not all of the lands that have been nominated by people would be protected, but what percent of the province would you consider has been nominated? Do you have any sense of that? I assume it's probably more than 12%.
Ms. Snook?
Oh, excuse me. We have identified the last 2.6% that we need to meet the 12% goal, and the staff have selected more than we need to make that 2.6% so we can go out and consult and see which is the most advantageous to Nova Scotians and to also consider what other impacts those lands would have on the economy.
Okay, I hadn't realized, and maybe I should have, I hadn't realized that you had already identified the additional 2.6 that you need.
Yeah.
When will that consultation process begin?
The staff have been working on that really during the whole time I've been deputy, yeah. Which is about a year and a half.
Yeah, no, I know it's an ongoing process.
And I think they're just about ready. They're doing the final preparation this fall, and they plan to have the next consultation early in 2013.
Okay. Canada has now federally signed on to the United Nations Convention on Biological Diversity, which actually commits Canada to a 17% target. I'm just wondering how the province plans to deal with that issue now. Because obviously, when this legislation was first introduced by, I think Mark Perrant was the minister at the time, it would have been 12%. And now, federally, the Conservatives have signed on to the new one.
We're very engaged in meeting our 12%. We're challenged, as Deputy Montgomery said, by the small amount of Crown land that we have in the province. So we're very focused on the 12% goal. We recognize that that Canada has hoped to achieve the 17%. So we're lucky to be part of the Federation because some provinces will have more than 17%, which may help us a bit. And we may have other goals that we want to look at after we achieve our 12%.
So when you look at reaching this 12%, if you take, there's obviously been lands that have been nominated by individuals and community groups and all that sort of thing over the past year or so in that process, but there have also been lands, and the example that immediately comes to mind is Sable Island, where I think most people, although it didn't have park status or things like that, would let's say it was a quasi-protected status. And there's been some talk that landmass would be used to reach the 12%, like lands like that that people already felt were protected. Is that part of the intent? Do you understand what I'm getting at?
I think okay. So, and I'd like to give Mr. Labor an opportunity to chat about that, because he can talk very knowledgeable.
Go ahead.
Thank you. To your question, we have, as the deputy said, we've identified initially more land than is needed to meet the goal, and we've also had lands that have been proposed by the public. And so part of our review process over the last year is looking at all of the lands that were released last June and the lands that have been proposed by the public as part of our consultation process to identify the best approximately 100 the best lands to meet our 12% goal for that additional 2.6%. In addition to that, there have been various designations while we're going through this process of lands that will contribute to the 12% goal. Sable Island is one of those. And it contributes less than 0.1%.
Yeah, I recognize it's a tiny area of land.
So as federal lands or privately protected lands are legally protected so they meet the definition of protected area under the Environmental Goals and Sustainable Prosperity Act, then they automatically contribute towards our 12% target.
So I guess what I'm getting at is that in some cases, and it's not, I mean, we'd have to go through and look at which lands get added, but some lands like that are not, they're really just a designation change rather than a practical use change or, so it's not additional. I wouldn't say Sable Island is additional protected land. I don't have any problem. Well, I have concerns about the park status, but for other reasons. But I have no problem with it being protected. But I think most people would say, well, it's fundamentally protected under its old designation. The new designation is probably not a bad thing. But depending, granted, that's only 0.1%, so it's kind of insignificant as a single piece. But in terms of principle, if you have quite a few of those parcels of land that people already feel are protected, then you're not really increasing the amount of effectively protected land in the province. Right?
There's not a lot of Sable Islands left in the 2.6%, I don't think, if that's what you are worrying about. And in fact, you know, Peter can tell you what is in the 2.6%, and they're not already protected. And you can tell that from our consultations, because we get a lot of people that have other ideas about what the land would like should be used for. So I think that consultation process has served us well in making sure that we're picking the right pieces, and will serve us well in 2013.
Is it possible to get a list of, I understand you probably don't have it with you right now, but a list of what makes up that 2.6%?
It's on the web now.
Mr. Labor?
The 2.6% has not yet been identified. So, I mean, we internally are now getting to the point where we're ready to release for a second round of public consultation the lands being proposed to fulfill the 2.6%, the gap between where we are now and where we need to be to reach 12%. We certainly have lists of everything that contributes to the 9.4%, which is our current protected areas. I have it with me. I could read it out for you.
That's okay. And I think we actually have that on a map.
And it's on the map, yeah. Okay. So, and it includes federally protected lands, provincially protected lands, privately conserved lands. The 2.6% will be the provincial proposal to advance to meet the 12% goal, and will consist of provincial crown lands. We are working very closely with federal partners and others to ensure that we're aware if there are any other lands that would meet the definition, so that we can account for that properly as we go into the last stages of the consultation to reach the 12%.
Last year, the province made a substantial land purchase from the Bowater lands. How much, if any, of that is projected to be used towards the 12%?
Yes, the province made a purchase earlier this year, and of about 10,000 hectares. And the expectation is that over 7,000 hectares of that will contribute towards the 12% goal.
Do you know offhand what you paid per acre for that? I know it was said at the time, I just don't remember offhand.
I best defer that to Gretchen Polkamp, or to DNR, to answer the acquisition question.
He was right, Gretchen's got the answer.
I was waiting for you, Duff.
The land from Bowater that we purchased in 2011-12, we paid $950 an acre for that.
Okay. When you're looking at the pricing, so the president of Bowater has recently said that, or has been reported as saying that the value of that land was more like $200 an acre, which is less than a quarter of what the province paid. And that's recently been reported by the Ecology Action Center and a number of others who obviously are groups that support purchasing the land, so it isn't people who were against purchasing it. I'm wondering how the price of $900 and some odd, and I know it's an average price, was arrived at when they seem to be quite happy corporately.
Mr. Montgomery?
Yes, and I thank you for the question. In dealing with Resolute, as we looked at the future and potential of Liverpool and the mill in Bowater, part of the dynamic that we arrived at, recognizing some of the challenges they had over the short term to keep the mill operating, we looked at a way that would benefit the province, at the same time give support to Resolute to keep the mill going in an appropriate manner. And we did buy, in 2007, we purchased 25,000 acres from Bowater for about $1,100 an acre. So we felt, from a couple of perspectives, that the $925 per acre was fair, but more importantly, as we began to negotiate with Resolute, and you have markers when you're dealing with companies like that as to how real they are in the way they negotiate with you, and Gretchen actually led a team of intergovernmental affairs of folks from different departments like environment, and also as well we had Mi'kmaq representation, in negotiating for those acres. And at the end of the day, we found Resolute's approach to us to be incredibly responsible. In fact, that we were able to achieve 25,000 acres of high value land. And many of our key and very diverse stakeholders have complimented the government for that particular deal. And again, back to our Crown land percentage, the very low percentage we have, the fact that we're able to add these very valuable acres to that our land bank, we also saw as a good investment for Nova Scotians.
I want to zero in on something you said there, which maybe I misunderstood, but it sounded like you said you were looking at a way to purchase the land earlier in the statement, but also a way to support Resolute at the time to keep the mill running. Are you saying that you knowingly overpaid in terms of market? I'm not debating whether the land was valuable, and I'm not an appraiser, so I can't tell you whether it was 1,100 or 900, 200. What I'm saying is that the company has mused about the value having been 200, and they got 900. When they're speaking to shareholders. So the question is, I guess, so it's just really a question for me is there's a discrepancy there, right? So that's great that under the previous administration, you paid $1,100 and you saved $200. But if somebody else is saying, well, you know, but really it was actually only worth $200 or maybe $300, I'm just trying to find that where that discrepancy is, because and what makes me concerned about that is I just heard you say that part of it was to support keeping the mill open. And that's obviously a policy decision. I guess what I want to know is, are you saying that that the department knowingly overpaid? Maybe you disagree with their 200 and that's fine, but maybe it was 600, but you knowingly overpaid by a certain amount to try and support keeping the mill running. Because that's what it sounded like you just said.
So, no, we did not knowingly overpay. And again, you're referencing public comments that I'm not familiar with. I am familiar in negotiations that were presently underway with Resolute around their land, and I know they place an incredibly high value on the 525,000 acres that are remaining. So in effect, we felt, given the sale in 2007 at $1,100 an acre, and the sale this time around, and the ability to get prime land through the final deal, was a good deal for Nova Scotia.
Okay. There is a difference in the value of the land, obviously, if the mill is operating, or it doesn't have to be Resolute. There is a difference in the value of the land if a mill is operating or not operating, obviously. It has a higher value if there's more demand. There's obviously less demand in the province now. I guess I'm trying to give you a way out. Does that explain? Could that explain? Well, no. I'm just wondering. Does that explain part of the potential price? Is that it could have had a higher value when it was purchased because it was conceived that the mill would be operating, and now obviously it's not, and there's less demand. And I mean, I think we all understand there's less demand.
I think in having been with DNR a year and a half, I've been really particularly in the last year around the serious issues we faced on the mills front, I've become very familiar with the value of our lands.
I have no doubt.
And I take your point about if there's a mill operating versus there isn't. But we've already seen incredible interest in those lands from various sources for future use.
Well,
access to fiber by any company, whether they're there or looking to come here, increases the value of that land.
That's not really true, though, because it depends on the use. I mean, it's partially true because it depends if there's more demand, there's more people interested. But the example, I mean, here's a perfect example, is that Nova Scotia Power just put out an RFP that anybody can go down the library and get in the paper, asking for 500,000 tons, I think is the number, of various types of wood for their biomass plant. When they were before the URB, they committed they would only be seeking 185,000 tons.
Yeah.
Biomass is the single lowest price available in the forest. In fact, some depending on who you talk to, some guys will tell you, and women, will tell you that they can't even get it to the road for the price that you're paid for biomass. So there's a big difference if it's 10,000 acres valued at a biomass price, which I'm not even going to try to remember. I used to know what the exact price was, but it's a lot lower than what it is for a pulp log, which is a lot lower than it is for a saw log. And I mean, you know that better than I do, probably. So I agree that the demand is different, that there can be an increased demand, but it also depends on what that demand is. And the single biggest demand that's just hit the market in Nova Scotia is biomass, right? Which would lower the average price of forestry product in Nova Scotia.
So I take the honourable member's point and agree. I think what we're sort of differing on here is the fact that Port Hawkesbury is now operating, and as of yesterday was printing paper, I'm pleased to say, has already will cause a difference in the marketplace as to the product that comes off that land and what you can get for it. So it's the same. If only Northern was left remaining, it's lower. And people that are looking at the Bowater lands, I'm talking the remaining 550,000, they view that from a business perspective of as real potential if they're able to operate or use that fiber, which in fact will impact the marketplace and be of benefit to contractors and small business operators in a positive way.
I agree.
Right.
I don't disagree with you on that. Okay. What I would say is that, and obviously I don't know all the people that are looking at those lands, but you know, we've probably all heard the rumors that maybe a mirror is looking at it for making wood pellets to co-fire. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. It's one of those rumors. We've heard that Northern Pulp's looking at it. Maybe there's some guys looking at it doing for saw logs for the housing market. Who knows? But each one of those would obviously change the value of that land, because if I'm going to buy that land for, and this affects the cost that you ultimately pay for the protected areas, land to use for protected areas, is if I'm looking at that land to buy it to make saw logs, then I'm willing to pay more because the money I'm going to get out of it is more than what I'm willing to pay for it to make wood pellets to co-fire in a coal-fired power plant, right? So I agree that the demand has increased slightly, but it's still less than, say, 2 years ago when Bowater was running, Northern Pulp was running at full tilt, there was a bunch of other mills, and New Page was running the paper mill and the super calendared press, right?
And I think if I can, to go back to the original point of the 25,000 acres, at the end of that process, I cannot begin to tell you how incredibly pleased we were with the high value land that we were able to negotiate with Resolute. It's definitely, I'm very confident it's higher than the $900.
Okay. And as I said earlier, I'm not disputing whether the land that you picked up was high value. I don't know each one of the parcels. I know some of them were definitely very valuable. And that's why I said that right off top. I'm not disputing that, Mike. My concern is, you know, and it is also reasonable that he spoke out of turn, but my concern is when, you know, you hear the president, you know, saying to people, well, you know, the value is in around $200 an acre. Well, and we paid $900 or $1,100 a couple of years. You sit there and you go, geez, you know, even if he's not, that's why I was concerned about your statement where you said we were also trying to keep the mill running. Because obviously the mill didn't end up running. And if we, I think it's, there may have been a public policy argument we could debate in terms of whether it was worth overpaying for land to keep a mill running, but you're saying that didn't happen. So I take it your word. I'm not. I just, that's why the question exists to me, is because of that statement, whether we were paying a little bit more to try and boost the viability of that mill. Because what's also happened is, I mean, we talked about New Page, and yeah, them coming back online and making paper yesterday brings up the price, but they're also paying less than, I guess it's not, it's Stern now. So Stern is paying less than New Page was paying for fiber. I mean, that was part of that whole fiber issue that they had to bring the price down. And I think we all, I don't know what the price is they're paying, but they say they're paying less. And so that brings the average price down too. It's really just about a price point. And I think I got the answer, you don't feel you overpaid for it. And that's fine.
Yeah,
sure, go ahead.
I think a key point to make, and this is from DNR's perspective, regardless of a mill deal, the Bowater Company traditionally in this province has been very stingy.
Order, please. Order. Unfortunately, Mr. Younger's time has expired.
Maybe remember
keep
the
that
answer.
Mr. McMaster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Maybe I'll just continue the discussion around the Bowater land purchase. You had mentioned that the amount paid was about $915 per acre. What was the original? We'd have to go back in time, but what was the land originally? I don't know if it was sold to Bowater many years ago or if it was given to them by some way of agreement, but does the department know the reference point from which they originally transferred ownership of that land to Bowater?
I'll try to answer first, and Gretchen will correct me if I'm wrong or add to it, but in 2007, we did purchase 25,000 acres from Bowater. We were able to at $1,100 an acre. So that was our reference point in the 2011.
Sure. Yeah. My father used to work on the railroad, and he started when he was 18, which would have been around 1942, and he remembers making out shipments to the Mersey paper mill. So back then, of course, the mill, that's a long time ago, the mill was in operation. I guess I'm just trying to get a handle on if Bowater as a company back then purchased land for its use, and if it did so, obviously I realize you'd have to include an inflation factor to put it in today's dollars, but I'm just curious to know what they would have paid for back then for that land.
Mr. Polcon.
As far as I know, a large portion of their land was purchased from the George Eddy Company. If it came out of the Crown, it was granted many, many, many years ago. So that it isn't a Crown sale to Bowater. It was way in the past that it came out of the Crown. And so it was privately owned when Bowater acquired it. And I don't know the price because those prices aren't recorded in our registry. All we have is the $1 that's usually on a deed. So when we were purchasing, we were looking at other appraisals, and we looked at the 2007 purchase, which had appraisals done on it. And we looked at some lands we appraised in 2010, which they were unwilling to sell us because they thought the price was too low. So those were the mm-hmm. parameters in which we were working.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the original sale would have been at probably the market value at the time that was between two private entities.
Exactly.
Okay. I was just curious about that. It's something I always thought about. You talked a little bit about using the amount in 2007 as a reference point, but is the valuation process that we use to evaluate that land available for review? I know you've used a reference price from 2011, but there were probably other factors that you looked at as well, and your complete review of the factors that you looked at to review that price that you came out with at $915 per acre, would that be available for review?
Yes.
What we were looking at was the land value. So we had already been working on trying to identify lands as the Department of Environment and DNR have been interested in Bowater lands for a number of years because that was part of the initial review for the 12%, and they had some of the prime lands we were interested in. So we have really been inspecting and reviewing their lands for a number of years, and we had picked out the lands that we really, really wanted. So when the opportunity came, we sat down with Bowater and we brought together our experts, so experts in forestry, from environment, from transportation, from Aboriginal affairs, the Mi'kmaq were involved, and we then looked at, so what would be the bare land value? What is the production value of the land? So is it in a class where the trees grow quickly or poorly? What kind of trees are on the land? How old are the trees? Is there water? Is it on a lake? Is it on fresh? Is it on a river? Those kinds of things which appraisers look at when they're valuing land. So we tried to break down the values that were associated with each parcel and ensure that the government was getting a good deal with the $950 an acre. So it's kind of a process we went through for each parcel, evaluating the conditions and assuring ourselves that the value was $950 an acre.
Okay. There's. Did you look at the impact on? And I'll give you. I know I've heard from people who work in the forestry sector. They sometimes bemoan the fact that so much land is tied up, and in the hands of one particular company. I know there'd be a lot of entrepreneurs in that area of the province that work in the forestry sector. Is that something that you looked at as well, if the province was, you know, going to buy land and protect it, but also did you consider the impact on local foresters who may want to have access to land that had been locked up for many, many years by Bowater?
Mr. Montgomery?
And I think it's important to remind ourselves that when we started with Resolute and we made the arrangement to access 25,000 acres, it was to be negotiated with them out of their 600,000 or 575,000 acres what those would be. And to Gretchen's point, by putting that team together, and to your question, that we are able to, from different perspectives, environment, forestry, and others, begin to see the key lands that we wanted out of that 575,000, we were incredibly successful. The 25,000 that we were able to achieve is basically, quite frankly, what we asked for. So because of the great work Gretchen and her team did, we were able to go into those negotiations with clear understanding of our objective. And more importantly, we were able to achieve those objectives.
Okay.
So, yeah, thank you.
So I guess roughly you've got about a 5% of the land that's total land that's owned by Bowater. But you were able to get, it sounds like, the best land, the land that you really wanted to protect.
And I think our stakeholders, diverse stakeholders, have confirmed that.
Okay.
As an independent third source, if I may.
Okay. Was there an option to protect this land through regulation or conservational easements instead of outright purchasing it, given the company was closing down?
I think, again, part of the dynamic and the relationship with Resolute, and I'm not an apologist for companies by any means, they had been frank and forthright with our government about the things they were facing and some of the challenges. And when it was determined, both from our perspective and theirs, that it was worth a risk to try to reopen the mill, part of the dynamic of those negotiations were around upfront how we could assist the company, at the same time protect the interests of taxpayers. And we felt the land purchase really was a good go forward on behalf of Nova Scotians, because they then moved to reopen the plant and move forward. And unfortunately, the euro went in the tank, which caused that to... But at the end of the day, we invested those millions of dollars and have a sound return on that investment.
Okay. If we move away from Bowater and just in general instances where the government looks at land, are there processes or regulations around protecting land that allow you to obtain land without actually purchasing it?
Snook?
There's a variety of ways that we protect land, and I'll let Peter tell you about the options that they have.
Okay.
Mr. Labor?
Thank you for the question. We do have a variety of tools available for protecting land and for protecting land that contributes to the 12% goal. So the simplest is to have legal protection through provincial legislation put over Crown land. We can also use legislation, several pieces of legislation, the Wilderness Areas Protection Act, for example, to protect land that is privately owned. We've done that in several instances where municipalities have had portions of their water, drinking water supply areas protected under provincial legislation while they still maintain ownership of the land. The Nature Reserves Protection Act also allows us to designate private land. And so we have several nature reserves in the province where a private landowner has come forward and said that they wanted to have their land conserved. And we look at the ecological values and agree that they are valuable, and then protect those under provincial legislation. We also have opportunities to protect land through working with private land conservation organizations. And they have several tools that they can use. One is by owning the land themselves. So groups like the Nature Conservancy of Canada and the Nova Scotia Nature Trust own lands, which, because of the way those trusts, those organizations are set up, those lands are conservation lands and contribute to our 12% goal. And then we also have the opportunity for conservation easements. So we have the Provincial Conservation Easements Act that can be applied over lands, and it legally binds the lands to protection, and those also contribute. So we have a pretty good toolkit for protecting lands, and when it's non-crown lands, then we work with private landowners who are interested in conservation to arrive at which tool works best for them.
Okay, I actually recently wrote a letter to the department about, because I had a constituent who was concerned about access to beaches over private land in cases where it was a traditional route for people to access the beach. And I think with a new piece of legislation last year, there's an ability to open discussion with the landowner and to try to open up an easement for the general public, I guess, so that they can still keep that traditional access route. Have you had any problems with landowners who may not want to give up an easement on their property to allow general public access to, say, for instance, to a beach?
Yeah, the legislation you're referring to is the Community Land Easements Act, and DNR has been the lead on that, so I think Gretchen or Deputy Montgomery would be best positioned to answer that question.
Ms. Holcamp?
The Community Easements Act is...
The Community Easements Act was passed in the last sitting, and we're working on regulations, so it's not enforced yet. So we don't have any actual application of the legislation, but it is a voluntary process, so the landowner does have to be in agreement to give the easement or to sell the easement, and that's one of the conditions, because it's really an agreement between two private organizations or individuals.
Okay. Thank you. Just moving back, we talked a bit about Bow Water. I'd just also like to ask a question about Pacific West, who just purchased the mill in Point Tupper. The province purchased land from them at a value of $20 million. What was the amount per acre for that land?
$388.
Mr. Montgomery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was $388 an acre.
Yes, okay. I remember it was around 400. So 388. And again, just going back historically, I know the mill started in 1962. When that mill was first started, what did they pay for the land back then?
Maybe for a reference point to the honorable member, in 2010, the province did pay more than $500 per acre for land from New Page, $5 million for about 9,000 acres, and they were high-value conservation land, there's no question. And I don't know if Gretchen's aware of other sales, but...
Okay.
I'm not aware of the original ownership of those lands, so I couldn't tell you what the previous purchase price was.
Is that something, Mr. Chair, that we could ask to be provided... maybe in writing to the committee, if you could look back to see who the former owners were, and if it was how the transaction took place, and what the amount on average was per acre back then.
The problem we have is that, as I had mentioned previously, sale prices are not recorded; they're not public information, so there wouldn't be any way for us to know what the sale price of the land was. I could determine who the previous owner was before all of the forestry companies.
Sure.
If that's what you're interested in.
Wouldn't a lot of that land have been Crown land, though, that was owned by the province?
I'm not aware of the land coming out of the Crown recently.
But this would have been back in the 1960s when the mill was set up.
We'll check into it when
okay.
we get back to you.
Okay, thank you. Just moving away from that, just quickly on provincial parks. I know that you've conducted a review. I actually asked the minister if he would conduct a review, so I was pleased when he did. Sometimes you get what you ask for in here. when is that review scheduled to be released?
And I thank the honourable member for the question. Over the summer months, in fact, we did carry out a very exhaustive public consultation process around parks, and it became abundantly clear how passionate Nova Scotians are about their parks and their use. And we're now in the process of collating that information and stepping back to have a look at it, and then it's our intent to, through the centre of government, through policy board and others, to go that route and then go back out one more time to consult with Nova Scotians.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, I don't want to put a time frame in there, but I'm hoping later in the fall, I don't want to put a time frame because hopefully before the next year.
Sure. Sure. So that would involve, I guess, going back to the public, sort of revealing what was discovered in the consultation and perhaps a proposed framework going forward?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. I know I have some parks in my area, and the passion is there amongst the local people for those parks. So
absolutely.
That's one of the reasons why, the main reason really why I had asked that that a review be conducted, just to make sure that everybody's on the same page. So so that's good. Just a question about donated land versus purchased land. I've been reading the papers the last number of years. There's people coming forward donating fairly large tracts of private land to the province because they want to see it protected. Is there, I guess, how would you decide the value per acre on those properties?
Ms. Montgomery?
Question?
Ms. Holcamp?
When land is donated, we still review it from the perspective of departmental programs. We have an integrated resource management review that we do on all of our lands, and that's one of the things we do to see if it's going to contribute to the values that we're looking for. And so when land is donated, we don't actually, because we're not paying for it, we don't need to do an appraisal or valuation in that sense. So we don't need to put a value for budgetary purposes.
Okay, and I guess just to clarify, there are instances, as you say, where the land is donated. Obviously, that's preferred by the province. It's a lot cheaper that way. How do you negotiate that? How do you encourage people to donate versus sell their property to the province? Are there incentives, or is there things that you tell people before they donate? Because for a lot of these people, there's great value in them knowing that land will never be maybe used again.
I'll defer this one to Department of Environment.
Ms. Snook?
We have people on the protected areas team that work with the private landowners around donations, so I'll let Peter talk to that.
Ms. Labor?
Yes, thank you for the question. One of the key parts of our program is working with private landowners to help them make the decision to protect their land. And in doing that, we provide a number of incentives, some of those which have been developed fairly recently. There was a brochure, I believe, in your package on private land conservation in Nova Scotia, and it outlines some of the federal tax incentive programs. And so we make sure we go through those with individuals as well. We let them know their opportunities for donating their land to the province, and also the opportunities they would have working with Nature Conservancy, Nature Trust, or other land conservation organizations. We also have fairly recent legislation passed in Nova Scotia called the Conservation Property Tax Exemption Act, which for lands that qualify for protection, landowners are now exempt from paying their municipal property taxes, and the province pays a grant in lieu to those municipalities for any lands falling under that. That's been a great incentive, in particular for land conservation organizations who hold a lot of land that qualifies for protection. But it's another thing that we can do for private landowners who have tax concerns, so we can add that with federal tax benefits as part of an incentive as well.
So they maintain ownership, but they don't have to pay the property tax as a reward for putting the land, I guess you could say, in protected hands with the province.
As long as it qualifies under a legally binding agreement like a conservation easement or ownership of a nature conservancy type organization, then okay, they can still maintain ownership.
Okay.
One of the keys for qualifying for legal protection is that it has to have a binding mechanism placed over the land that carries the land through from one landowner to another. Mm-hmm. And so we have to have that in place. And then we keep a tally of which are the qualifying lands each year for calculating those tax benefits.
Okay, thank you. In the case where private lands are purchased, is the process available for review as to how you'd put a valuation on land where the province decides it does want to purchase land from a private landholder?
Ms. Polkamp? Slow on your mic there, Ms. Polkamp.
Something? Okay. Sorry. The normal process we follow when we're speaking to landowners is we negotiate a price with them, and then we do an appraisal to verify that the price is a reasonable price. So our agreements of purchase and sale...
Order, please. Mr. McMaster's time has expired.
Thank you.
Mr. Ramey.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you all for coming in this morning. And it doesn't matter to me who answers my questions, whoever you think is the appropriate person. In listening to the question so far, it sort of becomes apparent to me that most people, at least over here, don't know very much about the value of land. I'm from southwestern Nova Scotia, where some of these lands are. Am I correct in assuming the Bowater lands are mainly in the area around, I'll say, St. Margaret's Bay, Queens County, and Annapolis County?
Ms. Polkamp?
Yes, they own lands in the southwestern county, so you mentioned several of them. There's a little bit in Shelburne County, some in Digby County, but mostly those southern counties. Some in Annapolis. Yes, Annapolis.
Thank you. And in the 2007 purchase, which I think went for, did I get it right, $1,100 an acre?
Yes.
Where were those lands?
Most of those lands were along the Mersey River and in that area of Queens County. There were very high value lands that the province was interested in for conservation. And there were also some Mi'kmaq interests in some of those lands.
Yeah, so there were indigenous interests as well as high value land. Yes. Was that land, did it have mature trees? Was it managed land?
It was all high value, so large trees, old growth, those sorts of things. Yes.
I recently went to an area in the Tobiadic or near the Tobiadic, I guess the Lake Rosignol area, where I saw a tree that was lying on the ground that blew over from natural causes. That was probably the best part of 12 or 15 feet high. You couldn't climb up on it without getting on. I had to climb up a tree to get on top of it. So there's some significant wood down there. Did these lands have access roads to them, or are there any access roads to this land?
You mean in the lands purchased in 2007?
Yes.
Do you know that, Peter? I'll defer to NSC. They've been down looking at all these lands very closely.
Mr. Labor?
Yes, many of the lands we purchased in 2007 were behind the gated road system for Bowater. And one of the reasons that they were in such high quality was that they were lands that had been administratively set aside by Bowater staff themselves because of their high quality old growth features. And so we had sort of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to acquire lands that had been managed for their ecological values by the company. A few of the lands were accessible by public road, like the lands along the Mersey River, but many of them were accessible only through the gated Bowater road system.
Okay, well, one of the things that I did admire about the Bowater company is that I thought they were quite responsible stewards of the land. I mean, I know large companies often get slagged for the opposite, but my understanding of what they did was... that was not the case, that they were good stewards of the land. I'm a woodlot owner as well. I don't know how many people over here own woodland, but I do. And I would not sell my land for $950 an acre to anybody. So if you got Bowater managed land with access roads, with mature trees on it, for $950, good on you. And I think it's very important that everybody realize that. I think people who don't get it maybe are people who don't value land. I mean, I can remember a debate in the House here. It was, I won't say who was speaking, but it was I don't know, November 15th or something, 2010. I remember the date because I wrote it down. And somebody who was speaking in the opposition said, "Why are you guys buying dirt?" They were referring to our government for purchasing good quality land that Nova Scotians wanted, and they were calling it dirt. And I remember taking, I couldn't say anything because I'm a backbencher, but I remember taking great umbrage that I was not impressed, did not like it, and I I recollect that if you think that the beautiful land that's down in that area of Nova Scotia is dirt, obviously you're not going to think it's worth very much money. The other thing is the enormous cost of putting roads in on woodland, good roads, roads that are accessible most of the year if you want to use them. That adds a significant amount to the value of the land. The purchase in the last purchase, I guess, in 2012. Where were those lands mainly located? In Queens County again? Am I correct or not,
Ms. Polkamp?
The lands we purchased in 2011-12 that closed in March were actually spread through the whole lands that they own. We were again looking for the highest value lands that had been identified through the Colin Stewart Forest Forum and the work of the departments on protection, and also lands that would address some of our forestry requirements and lands of Mi'kmaq interest. So we had some in Queens, some in Annapolis, some in Lunenburg. So they were spread all over. Really.
Okay. And I don't know who this question should go to, but is it a correct statement to say that the quality of wood growing on land in Nova Scotia varies significantly depending on what part of the province you're in?
I would agree with that statement. Our staff look at the land. The growing value of the land, that's one of the features that we consider when we're valuing land. So yes. Some classes, for example, the St. Margaret's Bay area, that's a very high growth area, grows very well, grows more quickly than other areas and some other areas of the province. So the Southwest is a good growing area.
And that's related to soil and climatic conditions?
Right, types of minerals in the soil, that sort of thing.
And so would you further agree that some of the most prime land we have, woodland, would be in southwestern Nova Scotia?
I would agree with that.
Okay. Well, I would too. And that's why I think good on you for getting some of it back. I guess I'm sort of gobsmacked by people who think, you know, that we shouldn't try to get some of these high-quality lands back. I've just been out with Minister Parker, but I've been out on my own a number of times with my colleagues, Vicky Conrad identify them by their ridings, the member for Queens and the member for Lunenburg. I'm the member for Lunenburg West. I'm sandwiched in between the two. Listening to people, sawmill operators, people who are very interested in the indigenous areas, the ecology folks, private woodlot owners, people who manage community woodlots. I've been to countless meetings down in that area because we now know there's another 550,000 acres of beautiful land down there waiting for somebody to come in and do something with it. And I haven't been to one of those meetings where I heard anything from anybody except the fact that they were desperately interested in seeing if we could acquire it. So I know that people, it doesn't seem to matter who you talk to, people in general would really love to have that land back. And it's, as you said, we don't own very much land here in Nova Scotia. People like me own most of it. And so I know there's a huge push to get some of that back, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more about that over the next little while. One of my colleagues, when they were asking questions, asked a question. I wasn't completely sure I got the answer on this, and it related to how are landowners or cottage owners consulted when a piece of land is identified for possible protection, like, and they happen to own. They own something there in the middle of it, and it wasn't before. And I think my colleague from, I think it was Mr. McMaster, that brought it up about a beach somewhere. Could you just tell me a little more about that?
Ms. Snook?
Secretary's team has done extensive consultations all around the province, and I'll let Peter explain to you what some of the opportunities have been for Nova Scotians to get that information and to make comments.
Okay. Mr. Labor?
One of the key things we look at as we're identifying lands for protection is not only whether or not they should be protected, which is certainly part of our process, but how do we do the protection in a way that we conserve the high ecological values, but also minimize our impacts on either adjacent landowners or the users of the land. Specifically addressing your question about private landowners, we have provisions in legislation that allows us to provide access to private landowners who might otherwise be inconvenienced by land designation around them. Typically, that comes up when we are looking at vehicle access through wilderness areas. Wilderness areas making up the vast majority by area of our protected area system. And so we have provisions in the Wilderness Areas Act to license access as needed by the private landowner. But we, through our planning process, try to avoid even needing to use that by looking at the private landowner's interests, by using boundary design, for example, to exclude main access routes. And if the private landowner is interested in conserving their land, as they often are, because quite often these isolated parcels are something that people have held on to because they value them in their intact natural condition, then we can also work with private landowners to speak to them about their options for private land conservation. Mm-hmm.
Good. Okay. Because I was concerned about that. I live in an area near, I imagine most people here would know where it is. I'm not too far from Rissers Beach Provincial Park. Just an absolutely gem, and kudos to, I think it was a Liberal member, Mike DeLory, who was really instrumental in pushing to get that made a park. The reason I think it's so important, the work that you do, is that was a beach that I went to countless times when I was a kid and countless times when I was a teenager, and then it was sold to a person from the U.S. who immediately dozed up a couple of large gravel banks and put up a no trespassing sign. And that was the end of the beach for the thousands of people that had gone there over the years until, to his credit, Mr. DeLory changed that up. And now it's a place that people from all over our province and lots of people from outside enjoy. And that brings me to my next question, because I've been working, as well as my colleague from Lunenburg, Pam Birdsall, and I have been working with a community group called the Kingsburg Coastal Conservancy, and we're trying to protect the West Ironbound Island, which is home to the ironbound sheep, but also it's home to a large number of bird species. It's like almost like a bird sanctuary. And the reason I love that island, and I think it's an important piece of property for us, is it's actually, there's an East Ironbound, which is down toward the Chester area. West Ironbound is right at the mouth of the Lahave River. And actually, if you stand in Dublin Bay and look out, you can see West Ironbound and then Mosier's Head, which is on Mosier's Island on the other side. And it again was owned by a person from out of province. The Conservancy was able to buy, I'm trying to get it right here, I think they bought the eastern half of it a number of years ago, and the owner has agreed to maybe let the western half go, but they've been trying to purchase it. So I know that DNR was working with that group for a fact, because I came to one of the meetings quite a while ago with Ms. Polkamp and some other people. But I was just wondering if there's an update on what's going on there. I know my constituents would be very interested in knowing that.
To Mr. Montgomery. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The department is pleased to be able to contribute towards the purchase of the land and is providing $200,000 to assist. And what's really the key point is the island will be managed under a stewardship agreement with the Kingsburg Coastal Conservancy, which is committed to maintaining, as you well know, and protecting the natural environment of the island. And in fact, they are contributing $187,500, and it's a win-win for Nova Scotia.
So that's going ahead. Excellent. I mean, that's a beautiful, beautiful piece of property. And I also would commend the folks, I mean, $187,000, and of course they've already purchased the other side. So I think that's quite phenomenal. I guess I just have one more question. And how much time do I have left, Mr. Chair?
You have until 10:08.
Okay, well, I probably got time for this then. You mentioned that, somebody mentioned that there are three different designations of protected lands. Let me get it right. I wrote it down here somewhere. So there's nature reserves, right? Wilderness areas and provincial parks and areas, okay? So can you tell me right now what percentage falls into each of those categories here? And I mean, it's kind of an awful question to ask. I realize that. I don't expect you to snap it right off the top of your head, but even rough numbers would be... we're going to get the actual numbers? Well, that's quite amazing, really.
Sorry, Peter.
I have to put my glasses on.
No, that's okay. You're allowed to do that.
Mr. Labor?
Thank you. I don't have the figure by percentage, but I can give it to you by hectares.
Okay.
And then somebody can do the math.
Okay. How many acres are in a hectare? Is it...
2.47. 2.471, Gretchen tells me. So.
You're good.
Listen, you're good, because a lot of people don't know that, but you do, so that's good. I knew that, too, but only as of this morning.
you notice that I often use hectares, and Gretchen also often uses acres, so we have to convert all the time.
I think that's the reason I just asked for the clarification, because for anybody who may be witnessing this, like a hectare is not a common designation. It's like talking in rods, which I think are 16 and a half feet or something, but most people don't know it. Anyway, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, so of the 9.4% that's currently protected in Nova Scotia, that equals a little over 516,000 hectares. Of that 516, I'm going to give you some round numbers, about 350,000 is provincial wilderness areas, designated under the Wilderness Areas Act. About 5,000 hectares is nature reserves, designated under the Special Places Protection Act. A bit over 10,000 hectares are provincial parks. And just for clarity, not all provincial parks contribute towards the 12%, so the provincial picnic parks, wayside parks, recreation areas, for example, do not contribute. All the provincial parks where the primary purpose is on nature conservation and biodiversity do contribute.
So would Risser's Beach Park, the one I just mentioned, be part of that?
I would have to check. I don't recall off the top of my head whether Risser's Beach... Some beaches do and some beaches don't, depending on what their primary purpose is.
So when we're talking nature reserves, which is one of the categories, which is about 5,000, I think you
correct.
Said?
Correct, yeah.
That's where we have maybe special indigenous plants or banding turtles or some species that we're concerned about not disturbing. Am I right on that?
That's right. Nature reserves tend to be quite small and are focused on individual elements that require protection, whether it's a rare species, an outstanding old growth forest, a wetland of ecological significance. So they're really feature-based. Mm-hmm. And are the most protective of the designations, whereas wilderness areas, for example, are really intended to protect things, ecosystems and habitats at a landscape level, and so tend to be larger but less restrictive in terms of the types of activities that can occur in them.
Okay.
And just for clarity, anybody that's doing the math will note that the three numbers I gave you don't add up to the total, because on top of that, we have federally qualifying lands, like national parks and national wildlife areas, and then the land trust lands. So those will make up the balance of the protection. So Cape Breton Highlands National Park, Kedjimkujik National Park contribute to the 12% as well.
Oh, do they? Okay, so they're rolled in there, and those are large.
They actually, are.
Very large tracts. So what would you say, in I think you told me that you've basically reached the 12%. I mean, you haven't, can't really announce it yet, but you're in the final negotiations to get the last piece for the 12%, not let alone the 17 if that ever happens or whatever, but... What seems to be the biggest challenges? Like when you were trying to do that, and apparently you're very close to doing that, or you are going to do that now. What has been the biggest challenge that you face in trying to do it? Is it the fiscal part, the money part, or is it some other issues that are constantly nagging away at you as you're trying to do it?
It's a very complex process because we're trying to achieve several things. One of those is identifying, protecting the most ecologically important lands in the province. And we're doing that from a limited land base. As has been referred to earlier, we have the lowest amount of Crown land, right. Second lowest in the country. And so without willing private landowners, our planning process is limited to what we can achieve on Crown land. Mm-hmm. We've had a great boost in our ability to advance on the goal through some of the land acquisitions that have been made over the past 3 or 4 years, because that's allowed us to reach outside
Order,
of the Crown.
Order, please. Unfortunately, Mr. Ramsey's time has expired. Mr. Younger, you have 14 minutes in this round.
Thank you. 14 minutes?
14.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. I wanted to ask, maybe I'll start with conflicts of land use. I know that some of the land, and this is inevitable, so please don't take this as a criticism, because I understand that this is inevitable in the process that's created, that you're going to have lands identified and nominated by the public for protection that may be high-value mineral lands, may be forestry, high-value forestry, other uses that are not, that don't mesh well with protected land. So I'm wondering how the process is addressing that.
Ms. Snook?
I was just going to say that has taken an incredible amount of time for the protected areas team. And I did want to clarify that, you know, all the lands have been identified where the 2.6% will come from. And it's on that nice map that Mr. Labor gave you.
Are they included on that?
Yes. So, you know, everything has been done very publicly. And people have lots of opportunity to comment and discuss. And that does bring, hopefully, all the variety of land use opportunities to the fore, and they're able to be analyzed. And I'll let Peter tell you how they actually do that.
On the map, though, just and I'll invert, but that is the nominated lands, right?
That's what it is.
Yeah, okay.
But I wanted to say the 2.6% will come from those.
Yes,
there won't
of course.
Be any surprises.
But this is what, no, I realize that, but that's what makes me ask the question, because I know that there are, and I know you've already received some letters from some, but I know that there are some parcels which have conflicting...
Oh, absolutely.
And you're aware of that. So, that is, I have seen this map. I've seen it online, but, I mean, some of them have... We've had people in my office going, that's my land, and I have a project here. You know, like that sort of thing. Yeah. So I'm wondering how you're dealing with that.
It's great to have that online, because it has provided
a lot of access
very
helpful.
For people. And you're right. You know, there are conflicts, but they're very adept at dealing with them. And hopefully we're getting the best value for Nova Scotians from each parcel.
Okay.
So,
Mr. Labor?
Yeah, thank you for the question. It is a something that takes a great deal of time as we look at these lands. So on the map, as we've referenced, we've purposely identified more land than was necessary to reach the 12% goal. And one of the reasons for that was so that we had the flexibility to make changes to adapt to areas where there is high conflict. So through that process, we have had numerous stakeholders come forward and identify areas where they have an interest, for example, a mineral development interest that overlies one of the 12% review land areas. We've taken the opportunity to meet with many of those individuals and companies to talk, to understand more specifically what their interests are and whether there's an opportunity to avoid the conflict, for example, through boundary design or through some other types of mitigation. And often that's the case. We also have worked closely with other departments within government, particularly with Department of Natural Resources and Department of Energy, who have put together a high mineral potential and high petroleum potential and wind energy potential layers that we can use with our mapping analysis, so that not only are we identifying the areas where there is current potential conflict, but areas where there is high values for those other interests that would conflict with protected areas designation. And so we have been looking at all of that because one of the tools that we have is to not move forward certain parcels of land where there is high potential for conflict. But we are prepared also that in the case where there is high ecological values that we feel really need to be brought to the forefront and potential conflict, to bring forward those parcels to government for a decision where one use may supersede another. We are working through the process to minimize the number of those parcels that need to come forward for a government decision, and I think the vast majority we will be able to deal with through the process using the other tools that we have available.
All right. In terms of if there is private land, and my colleague from Inverness sort of almost touched on this in a way, that somebody has put a conservation easement on or some other, or is willing to do that, but intends to keep it in private hands, would that be a candidate site for a protected, to be counted towards a protected area, or would that be something entirely different?
If they have placed it under a conservation easement, if there's a legally binding mechanism such as a conservation easement or provincial legislation placed over private lands, then it counts towards the 12%.
All right. So the example I'll give you, and Ms. Snook may be the best one to answer this, because she's either met with the person or is meeting with them, but up in Ben Bray, I know that they're looking at the whole, the part of it already has a conservation easement on it, but it's privately owned and obviously not accessible to the public, without family members there. But there's a part at the top that they're looking, making accessible to the public on an occasional basis, I guess, a few days a week, but which they were going to put a conservation easement on. Is that the kind of thing that would count towards the 12%? I'm just trying to get a sense of what does and doesn't.
Conservation easements are primarily focused on ecological biodiversity conservation. There are some older conservation easements that were for other purposes.
Okay.
Could be agricultural, could be heritage related. And so those typically would not count towards the 12% because their purpose is not biodiversity.
Yeah, probably was. I would suggest that I don't know what the... There is one easement there now, and I suspect that it's a heritage one or heritage-related. It is tied into the Bredora Lakes biosphere. So, I mean, it's sort of... It's one of those complicated ones that it's probably there for heritage reasons and the associated history of that site, but is also part of the biosphere.
So we would certainly look at it, and I'd have to... That's cheat fine. And look at the map to see whether it counts right now, but we're certainly open to looking at what is the primary reason for conservation. Another thing that's worth noting is that when the Community Land Easements Act was introduced, there were also some subtle changes made to the Conservation Easements Act to clarify which properties should be contributing for ecological reasons versus other reasons. So that will improve the situation going forward.
Yeah, and that was in, I think, the last session of the legislature. We did that. I remember that. The how are you dealing with lands that were assumed to be provincial but have no clear title on them? Who gets that one?
We work with DNR on that. I think we'll let DNR take the first shot at that.
Ms. Polkamp?
I think you might be referring to the lands that that are ungranted, unacknowledged Crown land. So we're working on a project now, and we hope to finish that soon, to clear the title to those lands. So we have a process in place where we review the occupation on the land. Some changes were made to the Land Titles Clarification Act last, I think maybe in the fall of the previous sitting, to make sure that we could do that in an expedited way. And what we're trying to do is clear up it. Initially, there were about 28,000 parcels that had a potential Crown claim to them. And we're trying to clear that up very soon.
Okay. And the reason I ask, I mean, there's a number of parcels like this that have been brought to my attention, I'm sure members of the government and the department as well. But I'm sure that nobody's going to be surprised that Department of Natural Resources here for protected lands is going to get away without a Shubenacadie Canal question. It's just not going to happen, right? And so I'm going to pass this letter over, and I mean, we can make copies, but the department or the government already has it because it was actually written to Minister Parker, Minister Pereira, and Minister Paris. So they all this isn't anything secret, but there, this is just an example of one with a PID number, and I'm not going to expect you to know about this parcel, but it's an example of the kind of issue that I'm wondering how you're going to deal with, where there is a land that everybody assumed was provincially owned, but has now come up as an unknown owner, and the neighboring property owner is now trying to claim, I don't even really know what the legal term is, but almost like a successor right, saying, well, listen, I've taken care of this
adverse
piece of land.
Possession.
Ah, there you go. Thank you. And now they're trying to claim that when everybody sort of assumed it was effectively provincial parkland and has historic resources on it and the whole bit. It's not the only one. It's sort of right along my riding, so that's why I know about this one. But there's other ones like this that have been addressed to me elsewhere in the province, and that's why I'm just I'll leave this with you. I mean, you guys probably already have it, but
there's a variety of situations like that, and owner unknown lands are another category of lands. So when the title ownership is unclear, then the municipalities can label them owner unknown, and there's a provision in the Municipal Government Act that permits the Department of Natural Resources to purchase those lands if we pay the taxes and the advertising costs.
Who would you purchase it from?
We purchase them from the municipality. So the municipality gets the taxes, and then we get a tax certificate, and that becomes Crown land. So we do that as often as we can. We constantly review the owner unknown lands to see which ones fit into our program requirements.
So all you would need to do in a piece like that, and I'm not asking you to commit because I know you probably... Mr. Montgomery has probably seen the letter, but probably wouldn't know it offhand, and I don't expect you to. But it's small parcel land. I bet you the taxes are about $1,000 on it, if I had to guess. Somebody would just the department would just have to go and pay whatever the tax bill, pay an advertisement, and it's yours.
There's a process set out in the Municipal Government Act that DNR can follow. If there's another claimant, which you have indicated, then they have a process by which they can assert. So it goes through a title review.
Okay.
But yes, it is a way that we can acquire ownership of land that otherwise we can't.
My goodness, I'm almost prepared to give you like the taxes now to go and buy it for the province.
Donations.
I'm assuming
we take donations.
I'm assuming it's only like probably going to be about $1,000. Is there? All right. We'll talk. It's a tiny piece of land, so I can't imagine. If that is the process, I actually assume it's probably actually fairly inexpensive. I could be absolutely wrong, but just judging by the property taxes on the other lots around that area, I would say that is it. I only have a couple minutes more. The other one I wanted to get at was First Nations. It was addressed earlier. What is their role in identifying the protected lands? Or as part of the process, I guess.
Been part of our consultation process, and if you want to hear some details about the committee that's been struck between Nova Scotia and the Mi'kmaq, Gretchen or Peter?
Well, I guess I assume that we probably have a minute and a half, so I just, okay. I assume correctly that they would have a higher standing than average Joe in the public who's just submitting something?
Mr. Labor?
I'll be brief so we don't run out of time halfway through. Yes, we've been working directly with the Mi'kmaq through the formal consultation process and the negotiation main table on the 12% and land protection for several years now. And they are engaged in the process at several stages. Nova Scotia Mi'kmaq can engage through the public consultation, but we're working with the negotiation office and have actually set up a committee that reports back both to government and the Assembly of Nova Scotia Mi'kmaq Chiefs on a regular basis. So we meet with them bi-monthly and are working through the process together.
Okay. There you go. You did answer that quickly. Have they identified specific lands that would have a heritage value in terms of Mi'kmaq history as part of this process, or is that being dealt with separately?
Yes, they have. They've primarily stuck with the process and identified their interest in relation to the 12% lands that we've identified, but they have identified some additional lands that they feel there is value in from an ecological perspective, and then other lands that they feel that they have value in from a Mi'kmaq heritage perspective, and we're not sure how to deal with those lands within the process, but we'll certainly work with our other departments like Communities, Culture, and Heritage to see if there is
order,
a pathway
please,
for those.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Younger's time has expired. Mr. Orell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
My understanding is there's 2.6% left to reach our 12% goal, which is about 189,000 hectares. And you say you've identified some parcels of land already. How much of that is private versus public land that's been identified? And is it identified as more, I understand, and but how much more would have been identified to the present?
Mr. Labor?
Yeah, the gap of 2.6% is about 150,000 hectares.
Okay, sorry.
And we are, the majority of that is Crown land. We are, when we release those lands, probably early in 2013 for next round of public review, they will be released as proposed protected areas. So there has to be a pathway forward for them to actually be protected. So we will not be releasing any privately owned lands that we don't have agreement from the landowner that they are willing to have those legally protected as part of the process. So we would see all of those lands going forward being Crown-owned lands or lands where we know that there's a clear pathway for protection with agreement with private landowner.
So that 150,000 hectares then is pretty well guaranteed to be online for the protected means as Crown land?
That's correct, yeah. Yes. If there were additional purchases made by the province in the meantime where there are high values, then those lands would be, they would become Crown lands and then would be released as Crown lands as part of that process. So, for example, we have a budget this year within Nova Scotia Environment to purchase some lands, and so we're working to expedite those purchases so that we can include those lands as part of our proposal that goes forward. So they're private today, they'll be Crown when they're released as part of the plan.
So most of the land is public land and is not private land?
That's correct.
So we don't have to worry about getting to that goal, and that 12% should be achievable because of the Crown lands.
Yes.
Now, in the past, there's been some public consultations on the private land. How have they gone? Have they gone smoothly? Has there been pushback from anybody in the area?
Sorry, can you clarify the question again?
If there was private lands being acquired before, the people come forward with those lands, or do we approach them to for those properties?
Yeah, typically it can happen both ways. The key is that any time that we even consider having private lands protected, it's just with a willing landowner. In most circumstances for the province, the landowner comes forward to us, although there may be occasion where we identify a particular ecologically important piece of land, and we may contact a landowner just to see whether they have an interest in protection. Mm-hmm. An example would be lands that are surrounded by existing protected areas. That would be a situation where we may contact the landowner. And then often conservation organizations like the Nature Conservancy and Nature Trust may have campaigns in particular parts of the province where they are much more directly in contact with landowners. So it can happen both ways. But the key is that we don't pressure landowners to protect or conserve their land. It's about them understanding their options and then being a sort of a willing landowner who is interested in conservation.
And are we getting any pushback from neighboring areas that those lands are being protected?
Yes, with interest to specific sites, we often have community organizations or individuals who are concerned with what the implications of protection may mean for their, particularly for their recreational use of the lands. And so we work very closely with those individuals or organizations to ensure that they understand what the implications are. We understand what their interests are, and we try to accommodate those to the greatest extent possible. So we've, as part of our process over the last little over a year, we've had more than 700 comments from various individuals and organizations, 150 of which were from organizations, and we've met directly with over half those organizations face-to-face to talk about what their particular issues or concerns are and look at ways to accommodate those interests while meeting our protection goals.
Are some of our woodlot owners concerned over this use of the land, the designation of this land?
We have not heard a lot from woodlot owners with concerns. We have had a few who have expressed concerns in relation to having woodlots that are near protected areas, and concerns that the a change in management regime over those lands, for example, not actively managing them or harvesting them, could have implications for adjacent woodlots. Science certainly doesn't support that area of concern in terms of pest, disease, or blowdown, those sorts of things coming from protected areas. But we have been talking to some individual woodlot owners. More typically, their concerns are about access to their lands.
That was my next question.
And so we work with them on a case-by-case basis, and certainly if they are private landowners whose access might be affected, our goal is to ensure that they can reasonably access their land for the purposes that they intend for it.
Thank you. With the newly acquired land from the Stern Group, New Page Group, would the capital purchasing price of the land deals start to go down now over the next number of years? Means it's ground land that we're going to be conserving? Or is there a budget for a purchase of conservation land?
Spokane?
The government has traditionally allocated funds to Department of Natural Resources for purchasing land, about $1.5 million, most recently $1 million to Aboriginal Affairs for a purchase of land, and Environment has also had a budget of about $1.5 million. And when special occasions arise, and there's been a program in place for the last 5 years called the Forestry Transition Program, we've had additional funds, $4 million a year for 5 years, to purchase surplus lands from forestry companies. And then, for example, the New Page purchase was an additional $20 million, or the Bowater purchase last year was an additional $23.75 million. So those budgets are added to our base budget, and as I think Mr. Labor pointed out, he has a $6.5 million budget this year, but it's expected that as we're achieving the goal that protection purchases won't be as significant in the future. But just to remember that we aren't just buying land for protection, we're also buying land because we do have a very low Crown land base, and we are trying to ensure that we have sufficient land to meet our fiber requirements under forestry agreements and to do economic development and other activities that we use Crown land for.
So you have been getting some support from Northern Pulp and New Page and stuff for the purchase of land for use for Crown and for fiber?
Well, the land we purchased from New Page, the 51,500 acres, that land is going to be used for forestry purposes and other economic development.
I guess I'll go a bit about the finances part of it. And Mr. Ramey from Lunenburg kind of got into the process, I guess, of the public and private land. But is there consideration about the recession and the strategy of getting on pace for this 12% by the 2015 as far as finances go?
I'm sorry, I don't really understand.
I was just wondering if there's any consideration of the impact of the recession and the spending of the money to buy the Crown land or to buy the protected land by the 2015 deadline.
No. Ms. Snook?
Defer to Ms. Snooks.
Ms. Snook?
I think we already have the land, as Peter mentioned, under Crown protection that is going forward for the 2.6%, so there really wouldn't be an additional cost. There's always a land budget where they're looking for additional pieces that are very prospective that when we can afford them, we acquire. But the 2.6 is already acquired. So we're living within our means in that regard.
Okay. Thank you. That's all. Thank you.
Finished?
Yeah.
Mr. McMaster, have any questions?
No. Nope. Okay. I'm fine, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Why Not?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thanks for coming in today. I only have a few quick questions, I think, more particular local questions in regards to the constituency that I represent. In particular, I just looking at the map, and you may not know the answer to this, and I understand that, but it's more of an interest to me, and I'm going to say that I'm not an expert on this, and since I've been elected, I've at least been able to understand it a little bit more, but there's a piece of it's colored in green on the map, so I would assume that's Crown land. Is that correct?
There's several
Yeah, okay, sorry. In particular, I'm looking at the Pocock Lake region, okay, up near, which is where we, as a lot of the municipality, get their water source from, for drinking water, who are on, of course, on city water. And in that, there's a piece of two colors there. There's a green and a red. The red is potential protection. Is that correct? So you mentioned earlier about other mechanisms that the Department of Environment have to protect lands and other sorts of things. So when I look at that, is that to say that right now, currently, not all of the land surrounding Pocock Lake is protected?
Mr. Chair, I can...
Yeah.
Oh, I'm on. Yeah, that's correct. There are several different types of protection in the province, and that's often confusing to people. So what we show on this map is the protection categories that contribute to the 12%. Something like a drinking water supply protected area under the Environment Act does not contribute to the 12% because the main purpose of that is for preserving drinking water quality. Now, we have several drinking water supply areas that are also designated under provincial legislation that qualify them for the 12% because they have high biological or ecological values. So the Crown land that's showed there is part of the drinking water supply area and is under regulations of the Environment Act to maintain water quality for public health and drinking water. The area that's shown in red there is the portion of that area that has high ecological values that are being considered viable for protection for biodiversity and ecological conservation. And so we're working with Halifax Water and the municipality, for example, to discuss whether the additional protection of a portion of those lands for protection that would contribute to 12% meshes with their wishes for the area and whether it adds value to the drinking water supply protection as well. So that's an example where we have those overlapping interests and it can get quite complex.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's why I wanted to ask that question, because just looking at it and, you know, for interest's sake, you know, when you look at it, it just looks, for someone like me who's a layperson in this regard, would be, you know, you'd it kind of makes you ask some questions. The other thing I wanted to speak about is, Mr. Montgomery, you talked about the consultation process, and hopefully over the next number of months, the consultation process will begin. And really, what I'm looking for is, how does a group or an organization become involved in that consultation process?
Mr. Montgomery.
And I assume the Honourable Member is referring to the parks?
Yes.
Consultation, right. So there are several ways. And as a matter of fact, we've established on the DNR website a place where Nova Scotians can access and make their comments. And again, it is our intent later on to go back out to the public one more time. But we would encourage and I apologize, I'll get the website for you and that contact information. But we welcome that, because part of the dynamic about our parks review is they have not been reviewed since the parks were set up in the mid-50s. Mm-hmm. And it's obvious from demographics and use, and it's very important for us to look for a vision to government as to how those parks should look over the next decade.
And just to follow up, I guess, Ms. Snook as well, the consultation around the 12%, is there another, I think you mentioned earlier that there's another round. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I may have missed when that's going to begin and kind of timelines for that. And again, how does a group get involved with those consultations?
Ms. Snook?
Again, in early 2013, we'll probably start those consultations. And I have to say the website is really excellent that mm-hmm. they have put into the protected areas consultations. And all the parcels will be posted there, and people can contact the department through that. And there'll also be public sessions that they can attend. Do you want to say any more about that, Peter? Or
Mr. Labor?
Yeah, I think at a high level, it's we're going to be very engaged with people as we go into the next round of consultation, and it will include opportunities to for people as individuals to work through the website or other media to contribute, and then we will have some form of face-to-face opportunity, particularly for the public, but we always provide the opportunity for organizations to approach us directly for one-on-one meetings where they have concerns or interests.
You mentioned before around the fact that we have the second lowest amount of protected or, you know, crown land in the province or in the country. So in 2007, were we worse than what we are now? Obviously we are because we're protecting more, but as far as, you know, as across the country. And so why did we begin this process? Why did the province of Nova Scotia begin this process? Was there a push from different organizations, from lobby groups? Was there some sort of a light bulb went off in someone's head and said, hey, let's do this because it is a good investment? Why?
There was an international move to recognize that protecting land was very important, and there's a little write-up in this little brochure that we included in your package that tells the organizations that were key in the late 80s with setting the 12% number. One of them was the Canadian Wildlife, or the World Wildlife Fund, and the other was a commission on environment and development. And I think that brought to the fore the importance of doing this for future generations and for biodiversity. And then it became part of the Environmental Goals and Sustainability Act in 2007 here in Nova Scotia.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you. I think I'm going to turn things over to my colleague, Mr. Scobar.
Mr. Scobar.
Thank you very much. And I have had the good fortune to have some dealings with your department. Mr. Labor, we had met on a number of occasions. When I first took office in 2009, one of the very first delegations that came to my office was a group called Cumberland Wilderness. And they'd been working apparently for years and years, and without a great deal of success. Now, finally, what had happened this year, the Kelly River and Ravenhead Wilderness Area were proclaimed. And this was the largest addition to the protected areas to date, if I understand correctly. Can you give us an update on the status of this land and outline the process the government went through to determine that this land should be protected in the first place?
Mr. Labor?
Sure. These were areas in the vicinity of Chignecto Game Sanctuary, which was an area really valued and treasured by not only people locally, but people across the province. And so prior to them being looked at specifically as protected areas, we, working with the Department of Natural Resources, conducted a review at the request of government of the Crown lands in the vicinity of the game sanctuary to see what would be viable for legal protection. We took about a year and a half to do that review, which led to the nomination of candidate protected areas there at Kelly River and Ravenhead. We had an opportunity, because of our large land purchases of land associated with Ravenhead, it was called the Applehead purchase, to include lands that had been recently purchased from Wagner to our consideration for protection. And then we went through a nearly two-year process of public consultation and evaluation of those proposed protected areas, working with municipalities, individual organizations, off-highway vehicle users, bow hunters, people who valued the land, as well as industries groups who had interest in those lands. And the outcome of that process of consultation and evaluation, we brought forward those two areas for designation. They received designation last year, I guess earlier this year, and we are now just awaiting the final deposit of the surveys for those areas in order for the designation to legally take effect under the Wilderness Areas Protection Act. And we're hoping to have that survey work done this fall so we can have the legally binding designation take effect very soon.
All things considered, I absolutely realized this was no picnic. The The Cumberland Wilderness is represented by one particular group, and the Cumberland Trails Association were really, really concerned. The Trails Association, the snowmobilers, and the off-road vehicle organizations, that they're that turning this into a protected area would severely limit their ability to use this land for recreational purposes. And by virtue of having taken this action, and likewise, I have to congratulate many of your staff, every single one that I met, somehow or other, you got these guys to play nice with each other, which has never happened in the last who knows how many years that they've been talking about this. So I just wanted to bring that to the attention of my fellow committee members as how that worked out, and I love it when a plan comes together. Now, and likewise, as far as DNR goes, I'd like to also offer thanks to the department there for giving some considerations when we bought some Irving land around Long Lake. There were, if I understand correctly, about 14 private cottages already owned there, and about three that were leased. And you're able to exercise some flexibility in allowing those, you know, those remaining three, which were, as far as to my understanding, less material in terms of absolute land value. And it might have been different if they were all leased and we were going to take over. But just to leave the three or four lease properties. Well, to let them be, basically. Now, is that an issue with a lot of our land purchases, or just here and the odd one here and there?
Mr. Montgomery?
I really thank the honorable member for his comments, because since coming to the Department of Natural Resources, I continue to be amazed at the sensitivity that our collective teams have shown in dealing with those kinds of issues. As I said in my opening remarks, Nova Scotians are very passionate about their land and how it gets used. And there are often differences of opinion of how the land should be used. And I've seen many instances that you've, for example, some that you've highlighted, where our staff have worked incredibly diligently with those opposing interests to try to bring a successful conclusion to meet government policy objectives. So, yes, it happens. And there is a dialogue and negotiation that often has to take part, rather than a prescriptive come in, do it our way or the highway.
Well, I'm glad that we don't have necessarily a one-size-fits-all kind of policy on that. I don't know who this question should be directed to, but is when we determine like what kind of land is coming up with the remaining percentage of...
Order, please. Unfortunately, your time has expired. Your 14 minutes are up. I'd like to thank the guests for coming today, and I give you both, Ms. Snook, perhaps first, an opportunity to any wrap-up comments you'd like to make or anything that sort of we left lingering when you were cut off.
Do you have anything you want to add? Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and we are glad to have had the opportunity to answer your questions today about our Protected Areas Program and to share with you the great progress that is being made to protect our valuable spaces. Parks and protected areas are important in maintaining our natural heritage. They safeguard our best remaining natural areas and are part of what makes Nova Scotia such a great place to live. We want to ensure that as much land as possible is available for Nova Scotians to use and enjoy now and into the future. A great deal of work has been done to get us where we are today, and I also appreciate that many of you have commented on the great job the team has done between natural resources and environment. The staff are very dedicated to this area and are doing a fabulous job and have worked very hard. And it's made it very easy for Deputy Montgomery and myself to participate today. About 9.4% of the province is now legally protected, and we are well within reach of the province's 12% land protection goal. Our progress is due in large part to the involvement of Nova Scotians. They have expressed their interest in preserving our most valuable natural spaces and have been engaged throughout the process. In fact, we have met with and heard from thousands of Nova Scotians over the past few years about 12% lands. And we have received great feedback in terms of both the need to protect and preserve our land and to ensure its availability for individuals who depend on it to grow their companies and provide good jobs for Nova Scotians. Together with the input of Nova Scotians, we are protecting sensitive lands while supporting a prosperous and sustainable economy. Our next step is to develop a proposed parks and protected area plan reflecting what we've heard from Nova Scotians during the recent 12% lands review. We are aiming to release this plan in early 2013. Once this is released, Nova Scotians will again be asked to provide input. We look forward to working with you and all Nova Scotians as we complete this process and designate the remaining lands needed to achieve the province's goal. Thanks very much.
Mr. Montgomery.
Very briefly, I want to echo my colleagues' comments in many ways and be a little selfish as Deputy Minister of the Department of Natural Resources to once again say to the honourable members the lack of Crown land that we face has always been and will continue to be a challenge. And the fact that in the last decade, successive governments, including this one obviously, have really committed to trying to add to that base in a very constructive and positive way. And I thank the honourable member for their questions.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank both departments for coming and providing us with all that information. There was at least a couple of things that were asked for and committed to by the departments. A list of the 2.6% of land that Mr. Younger asked for that was committed to providing. And the clerk, by the way, will give you more detailed information on this. And also the value of the land of sale in the 1960s around Mr. McMaster's question. Is there anything else from the clerk? Did I miss anything? No. Okay, thank you very much. We're going to continue our meeting. You're welcome to stay if you want, but no need to. So with that said, I want to go into the next part of our meeting, which would be, I guess, the first one on our list there is the committee business is the record of decision. Now, we have several topics here that have been moved forward by the subcommittee. All of them except one were by unanimous consent and by the committee. And how would the committee like to handle that? Mr. Wynot.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to move that the topics as presented on the record of decision by the subcommittee for future Public Accounts Committee meetings as presented with the exception of the Office of Policy and Priorities.
Okay. Mr. Younger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know whether we want to do that and then have a separate vote on the other one. We can do it either way, I guess. I was not obviously at the subcommittee meeting, but I would be, it's a little bit surprising that the government wouldn't accept having the Public Accounts Committee review the Office of Policy and Priorities, since that seems to be very squarely within the mandate of the Public Accounts Committee and their primary role. It also seems to be a bit odd, given the previous statements by the NDP when they were in opposition, that all these sorts of areas should be under the review of the Public Accounts Committee. So I wasn't at the your subcommittee meeting, obviously, Mr. Chair. So I don't know what the discussion was there, but I think it would be informative to know because that seems to be, as I say, squarely in the mandate of this committee.
And Mr. McMaster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was at the subcommittee meeting and knew that this was going to be brought back before the larger committee. We did approve it at the subcommittee level, but as you know, the government often brings back things that it doesn't want to talk about to the broader committee here so that it has the power to vote them down. So we're seeing it again. I don't see anything wrong with calling the Office of Policy and Priorities for questioning. The purpose of this committee is to examine public expenditure. Tax dollars are used to fund this office. It would be nice to have an update on what's happening in that office, and if we have questions, to be able to ask it, just like we do with any other office or department in government that spends the taxpayers' dollar. So we have no problem with this coming before the committee, but obviously the government does, and it looks like they're going to use their majority on the committee once again to stop us from having the opportunity. Thank you.
Mr. Younger?
Since it's obviously going to be an issue, maybe obviously we can vote on the unanimous ones because that's simple, and maybe we could have a recorded vote on the policy and priorities.
Yes, Mr. Wynot?
I put forward a motion, so I just ask for the question, please.
Mr. Younger?
I guess I'm seeking clarity on the motion. The motion, as I understood it from Mr. Wynot, was for to vote on all of the items with the exception of that one. So I'm just trying to... All right, well then I would ask for, if that's the motion that we're going to have, then we'll have, I would ask for a recorded vote on that motion then, because obviously we do not accept that motion, given that it has the exclusion of that particular department.
Mr. McMaster?
I agree.
Mr. Wynot?
Mr. Chair, what I asked for was the adoption to, I move the topics as presented, with the exception of the Office of Policy and Priorities. That was the motion.
So my understanding, to make it clear, is that the it's been moved that all except for the Office of Priority and Policy and Priorities is what we're going to vote on first. Is that what the motion is? Okay. That's the motion, excluding the one from Policy and Priority. And we'll talk about that after the initial.
No.
Oh. One motion. Okay, it's been called for a recorded vote, and we'll start with Mr. Boudreau.
Yes.
Mr. Wynot?
Yes.
Mr. Sakabara?
Yes.
Mr. Ramey?
Yes.
Mr. Steele?
Yes.
Mr. Younger?
No.
Mr. McMaster?
Mr. Chair, I'm a little confused on the motion, because I understand that it's been taken... I think I'm going to vote no. It's not going to make a difference anyway, so you can record my vote as no.
Okay. Mr. Royal?
No.
And my vote is no. The motion is carried as put forward, and those items will be put in the agenda. And with the indulgence and the concurrence with the committee, I think if we could leave that to the clerk to set up the earliest possible date. Now, that may be maybe going to ask the clerk to make some comments on that, because she's been doing some work on it already.
It's just that the next meeting date will probably not be until around the 24th, only given time for people to respond and to get a briefing package ready.
Would that be satisfactory with the committee? And I understand the PC caucus also has a out-of-town caucus during that, before the 24th as well, so which would take another day. So we can plan around the first meeting of the 24th and leave it to the discretion of the clerk to align whichever ones we can get, considering the legislature is going to be in place about that time. So that handles that. There's also, at our committee meeting, we talked about reports of chapters in advance of the meeting. This is something we talked about and unanimously agreed to the subcommittee, that a week prior to a decision where an Auditor General's information, we're going to ask questions on an Auditor General's report. The Auditor General will give us an in-camera briefing the week before for half an hour prior to the next week's meeting. To give the committee an understanding of where the Auditor General is coming from on this, and refresh our memory on it, because some of these things are quite old on our books. Let's put it that way. Does the committee agree with that, Mr. Wynot?
Just simply a question, Mr. Chair. And again, I wasn't at the subcommittee meeting, but is that for every chapter that is brought forward, or unless the committee requests it?
It would be for every chapter. And it'll not necessarily be half an hour, but we'll allow half an hour for it. It may be very short. Okay, is it agreed? Great. So that's passed. There's a letter from Mr. D'Entremont, which has been distributed to everybody. It's been requested by the PC caucus that that not be called today. Okay. The other thing was, in our subcommittee again, elimination of the half-hour lockdown in-camera briefing by the Auditor General. In other words, we took the opportunity to read the report, and then we asked questions. We're proposing we eliminate the reading part of the report and let the Auditor General do a more in-depth briefing in-camera to the committee, and then the committee can ask questions on it. We'll just save us an extra half hour and let the Auditor General go right into it, and we can read it afterwards. Is that agreed by the committee? Okay. The use of cell phones, I think we're already doing this, but it's something that had been brought up, that the cell phones continue to be allowed like they were, but the ringers be placed on vibrate and nobody have any conversations in the chamber. And I can't recall a time that has ever been a problem, but just wanted to make a part of the record. Now, And their annual report is about to be signed. If everybody's agreement with that, we'll... Mr. Why not?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that the annual report for the Public Accounts Committee be accepted as presented to us by email, I believe it was.
Seconder for that? Mr. Younger? It's moved. All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carried. Okay. Anything else we have on the agenda there? No, I guess that's it. So our next meeting will be approximately on the 24th, and we will advise the committee as quickly as we possibly can. A motion to adjourn will be in order. Mr. Wynot, we stand adjourned.